I've changed the title slightly of my session to What Does Contemplative Pedagogy Mean for Us as Teachers? And if we're going to, and we touched on this last night, if we're going to invite our students to learn in more contemplative ways, I think it brings up an interesting range of responsibilities for us as a teacher. So Barbara Zantenbusch, in the textbook that Paul and I were talking about yesterday, says, "There is no effective way to teach contemplative practices without practicing them yourself. While many practices in this book are rather simple, they all require the awareness that comes with committed practice, including the experience of their varied consequences." And the example they offer is, it's all very well telling students just to follow the breath, but unless we've attempted it ourselves, we don't actually realise how difficult that is in reality. So I think it brings up a range of responsibilities. And I think there's also issues around safety, around knowing the ground to which we're taking our students. And if we've never been there ourselves, are we aware of what we're opening up? Are we aware of how appropriate it is within a classroom setting? So, and there's also technical issues of when and where is it appropriate to use contemplative practice. For example, a course that I'm teaching at the moment is called Developing as a Compassionate Practitioner, and from the outset, people sign up to that course knowing that it's about mindfulness, that it's about self-compassion, and that these things will be practiced in the class. So I feel like I've got a really broad remit to bring in a range of practices, but is it fair to expect students to do the same as part of a standard curriculum? I think there's a tension there, and raises interesting questions. However, I do think there's something more fundamental going on in my eyes about when we step as a teacher into the realm of contemplative pedagogy. So if we're to introduce and reconnect students with their sense of meaning and values and to develop a sense of who they are, we have a duty, I think, to do the same. And I think we need to become aware of our intentions as teachers, and to start to broaden our sense of responsibility to them as helping them to pass the course, or actually do we have a broader responsibility? And actually does our vision of teaching help to really fuel the kind of teaching that we want to deliver? And so that's the kind of thing that I want to look at today. So I'm just going to read a short extract from Parker Palmer, who has done a lot of work around the lives of teachers and what it means to really develop as a teacher. So he says, "After 3 decades of trying to learn my craft, every class comes down to this. My students and I, face to face, engaged in an ancient and exacting challenge called education. The techniques I have mastered do not disappear, but neither do they suffice. Face to face with my students, only one resource is at my immediate command: my identity, my selfhood, my sense of this I who teaches, without which I have no sense of the thou that learns. Here is a secret hidden in plain sight. Good teaching cannot be reduced to technique. Good teaching comes from the identity and integrity of the teacher. In every class I teach, my ability to connect with my students and to connect them with the subject depends less on the methods I use than on the degree to which I know and trust my selfhood, and I'm willing to make it available and vulnerable in the service of learning." So I think in that paragraph he really brings to mind some of the issues that I think are most important and that I'm going to talk a little bit about now. But it's not about being a good person. He talks about identity and integrity. And it's not that being a good person means that we'll be a good teacher. It's about being a whole person, about being willing to stand in front of a class despite our nerves, despite our bad experiences of teaching, despite those days where we've been an awful teacher. We stand there as a complete person. Or, complete's probably too much, as whole as we can be in that moment. I think it's probably better. And so for me, this has developed a sense of being able to be more present in front of my students. Not to get lost in the hopes and the fears that I have for that session, but actually to sort of face what's there. As when I first started teaching at the university, I can remember not really being conscious of the moment I walked into the room to the moment that I left. I know that I said something in the interim and flicked through a few PowerPoint slides, but other than that, I couldn't really tell you very much. And I would just want to plough through my slides without making a mistake, whatever a mistake might be, in that context. So I used to be very unaware. And my sense of myself as a teacher used to be incredibly tied up in the reactions of my students. So if I had a sea of fascinatingly engaged faces, which is a real rarity, I would feel that I was a great teacher. And if everyone seemed confused, it was because I was a rubbish teacher. And of course, neither of those things were true. And so as I've become, it's not that we should not respond to the reactions of our students, but when we develop more of a sense of ourselves as a teacher, our ability to teach regardless of the reaction that we come from students and to deal more creatively with their responses develops, because we are able to, we're not completely thrown, our sense of self is not completely undermined by a sea of blank faces, which is quite a difficult thing to deal with. So part of becoming more familiar with them in our lives, more familiar with our inner lives, is about becoming more aware of the meaning and values that we hold dear and that really motivate us to act in our life. And then we can, when we realise what we want to live for, I guess, is not too strong a word, we can then learn to align what we do in life with the things that we really value. And very often, certainly in teaching more of the boring stuff, I used to find it very difficult to get in touch with the values and to see the wider remit of why I was teaching. I would just get bogged down in the technical detail of the facts that I had to get across and lose a sense of actually what am I trying to contribute, what development do I want to see in my students. Now, I'd never really considered this before going to the Amiga Institute in New York last year for this workshop. And there, we had to think about what it was that really drove us to teach and what our vision for our teaching was. So it's not about magical, idealistic thinking, but it's about deeply considering what does teaching really mean. So it's not about getting lost in visions of perfect teaching or perfect outcomes, but it's about what is it about my teaching that really matters to me, and knowing that, and being able to teach from that. So I've made another connection recently which seems related to this area. So in my Buddhist study group, I had to give a talk on emotion in spiritual life. And so in doing this, I read something that is now blatantly obvious to me and had not occurred to me before. It's the fact that as human beings, we are incredibly emotional beings. And actually, a lot of our decision making is fueled by emotion rather than reason. And often we'd like it to be otherwise. For example, we know what we need to do to be more healthy. You know, exercise more regularly and eat less cake. And what do? I go straight home instead of going to the gym and I have an extra slice. So there's... We often know what we need to do in terms of reason and intellect, but very often emotion steps in and we act differently. And so I think in order to really develop, or certainly my experience has been, that if I can really touch or get in touch with the values and meaning behind my teaching, that there is an emotion that comes with that that helps to fuel what I then do. And that emotional energy is far more powerful than knowing with my intellect or my reason that that is how I should teach. At least that's been my experience. So this emotional force of having a sense of something bigger than perhaps what we originally thought. So instead of helping students just to pass, which I think was my, especially through the first year, just please don't let anyone fail, they might fire me. Then when we get in touch with something bigger, we can do more. And I guess actually being here today and the work that I do have done with the network is a sense of that, of seeing something bigger and being emotionally drawn to doing that and being willing to put in the extra work, because if there wasn't an emotional commitment to that, I probably would have just come back from New York and thought that was a nice trip, not done a lot about it. So In developing our sense of vision, and don't panic, I'm not about to ask you to write vision statements or anything awful like that. No, don't worry about that. But it's not about putting it into stone. Just visions of Ed Miliband come to mind then, sorry. it's not about setting into stone what it is that we want to work for. But it's about having a sense of... it's about bringing ourselves into closer touch with what we're working towards. And also noticing that that's going to be something that changes over time. It's not about saying, this is absolutely what I teach for. It's this is what's true for me at this moment. And being aware that that will change over time as we grow, as we develop as teachers. So I think if we're asking our students to do the internal work, and we might be doing so more or less explicitly, depending on what methods that we're using, the least we can do is try to teach from that place. And to bring ourselves into our teaching more consciously. I think very often, and again I refer to my first couple of years at Essex, was really I stood behind the content, desperately hoping that no one saw me, because I didn't want to be asked a difficult question. And I think one of the real moments where I felt my teaching barriers break down was when I was doing a lecture on Foucault, and we were talking about surveillance in society, and I had quite a challenging group of undergraduate students, and the only way I thought could think of getting my message across was to talk about bikini waxing. And because of the role that social surveillance plays in that, and it was one of the best classes that I've delivered, but because the response was so strong and everyone, it was all female class actually, so there was a really strong resonance in the room about what I was talking about. And it's the first one of those moments where you think, yeah, I wish I could bottle that teaching, because it doesn't happen every day. But I felt more exposed because I was having to share something about my life and about something that, you know, doesn't take up a huge amount of my time. But, for fear of digging up. But anyway, it was one of those moments where I felt exposed, and I knew that, but I knew that I'd got through, through thinking about it differently, not hiding behind the information that I was trying to put across anymore. And my concern is that somehow we are becoming lost in institutional bureaucracy. So just to pick up on something that Robert Lilly was touching on last night, I think that is serving to constrain our sense of how our teaching is impacting the world. It's about getting students decent degrees and getting them jobs, and not really seeing them as people. And I see it on paper increasing the reference to transformative education. And I'm trying not to be too cynical about it, because I think the fact that people have really picked up on this as being necessary, I think it's a good thing. And so, although it's easy to become bogged down by the negative side of things, I think the fact that there's six of you sat here for one university today implies that there is an energy around developing change. So, yes, so I won't get too bogged down in that. But I do think sometimes the way that we're asked to teach means that we often focus on the small stuff, on the getting people through, on the what grades people getting, what's our SAMP score, that's institutional language for evaluation score, you know, those kind of things, and to lose a sense of the bigger stuff. Okay, so another example I wanted to give you was the fact that I knew that I found critical appraisal teaching really boring. And despite my best efforts, I, in fact, particularly last semester, I just thought, I don't know what I can do to make this more interesting. I teach it to continuing professional development students who often have a very limited interest in research. So it's quite a challenging environment to be in. But actually, after the work that I did at the Amiga Institute, I realised that this wasn't just about bringing our intention and our vision and our wider sense of teaching to the interesting stuff. It was also having a sense of some of the more boring stuff and how that can contribute to students' development. So I've already touched on that, but I think it's an important point to make that this isn't we can bring imagination and connection and energy to teaching which perhaps doesn't call us in a way, but we can still have that connection with our students and we can still make it transformative to the best of our abilities. Okay, so what we're going to do now is a 15-minute reflection exercise, and it's very much like a meditation, but I will be a lot like Ido did actually in the video last night. I will be dropping in questions, and in a reflection, the idea is that you are not just engaging your intellectual mind, that you're kind of allowing a space for an answer to come up. So when I pose the question, the idea is, I mean, your mind will grasp it instantly and instantly try and answer it, but the idea is that we just allow the question to be and to see what comes up in relation to it. So to try and allow a space around the question for something to come up within us. And there'll be four questions overall. And I'll introduce them in turn during the practice. And when something comes up in response to a question, just allow it to be, and it will probably find its own way out, and then something else will arise. But try not to grasp an answer, which is easier said than done, because we all want to know the answers to these questions. But we're trying to give space to something deeper to arise. And then what we're going to do is to... Well, there's not a number. Okay. We are going to do a feedback exercise. And during the feedback exercise, you'll be working in pairs. And we're going to be going to tap into something called deep listening. And when we are involved in deep listening, we are trying to be as present as we can possibly be with what the other person is saying, which is, again, easier said than done. And so I'll remind you this of Nearer the Time, but really what I'm asking you to do as the listener is, as soon as you find yourself getting caught up in your own thoughts or distracted, just to come back to what the other person's saying. So it's a little bit like a breath awareness meditation, but your point of awareness is what the other person's saying. And very often sort of a way of listening often involves a lot of analysis, a lot of, oh yeah, I really agree with that, or oh, I don't know, and then we go off into a story about how we're going to respond. As a listener in this situation, you do not have to respond in any way. You have to be engaged, but there's no pressure on you to give any answers, so you don't have to get caught up in that. You can just listen to what the other person's saying and be open to their experience, and then we'll swap around. Okay, so some people were saying that they weren't particularly comfortable on the chairs. So if I have brought a blanket and a yoga mat, and I think some people have brought other things, so if you would like to lay down for this, please find a suitable space. But if not, then we'll be sat on the chairs, feet flat on the floor, in sort of a meditation posture. So, is anyone wanting to lie down? Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you.
So, if you're comfortable too, just closing the eyes. And if you prefer to have your eyes open, just resting a gentle gaze on the floor or perhaps on the ceiling if you're lying down. Just making sure that we're as comfortable as we can be. Just bringing our attention to the breath, first of all. Just noticing the breath coming in and out of the body. Perhaps we can feel the rising and falling of the abdomen. We'll feel the breath coming in and out of the nose. Just resting our awareness on the breath. Thoughts come up, we just come back to the breath. So when I pose a question, there's no need to cling to or to search for an answer. Just allow whatever response you have to arise naturally. If there's no response, that's fine. First question. Why do I teach? Why do I teach? Find yourself getting lost in thought, come back to the question, why do I teach? Ourselves to sit with the question, why do I teach? Bringing yourself back to the question, why do I teach? distracted. There's no need for recrimination or judgment. Just gently bring yourself back to the question. Gently letting that question go. Coming back to the breath. What effect do I want my teaching to have on me? What effect do I want my teaching to have on me? Allowing that question some space. Holding it in our awareness. Allowing whatever response to arise. Teaching to have on me. Trying to drop any analysis or intellectual engagement. Just resting our awareness on the question. What effect do I want my teaching to have on me? Letting that question go. Coming back to the breath for a moment. We're finding it difficult to concentrate. Finding ourselves caught in stories. There's no need for judgment or recrimination. Being gentle with ourselves. What effect do I want my teaching to have on my students? What effect do I want my teaching to have on my students? Resting our awareness gently on that question. Trying to quiet the intellectual mind to allow some space. Noticing what arises. teaching to have on my students. What effect do I want my teaching to have on my students? Question go. Coming back to the breath in the body. Last question. What effect do I want my teaching to have on the world? What effect do I want my teaching to have on the world? Allowing our attention to rest on the question, holding it within our awareness, allowing space around it so that something may arise in response. What effect do I want my teaching to have on the world? Being gentle with ourselves, knowing that we're trying the best we can, to the best of our abilities, bringing ourselves back to the question, what effect do I want my teaching to have on the world? Allowing a response to arise. last time, just coming back to the question, what effect do I want my teaching to have on the world? Letting that question go, just resting for a few minutes, sensing the overall vision of what you want your teaching to contribute to, just being with that to the best of our abilities. And then letting that go too. And just becoming aware again of the bodies in the room, lying on the floor or sat in the chair. Maybe taking a few deep breaths, reminding ourselves who we're here with. Perhaps wriggling fingers and toes. And then when we're ready, and there's no rush, opening the eyes, coming back into the room. So you now need to find yourself a partner and to feedback your experiences to each other. So we've got about 10 minutes for this, so you've got some space. If you would like to do this standing up, if you need to have a move around, then please do so. It's probably going to be easier if we're not all sat in the circle, it might be a bit too noisy. So find a corner of the room to take your partner to.
I can't teach very roughly.